For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to spend most of the hour listening back to an intriguing interview that I was privileged to record back in 2004 with a gentleman by the name of Richard Thieme. Richard Thieme was born and raised in Chicago and for a time was an Episcopalian priest. But Richard Thieme found himself drawn increasingly into the world of technology, and particularly as technology began to move forward in exciting and even bewildering ways, Richard Thieme found himself called to comment upon it. He did so in public speaking, in working with various companies wrestling with technology issues, and in the mid-1990s, he began writing a well-received column called Islands in the Clickstream. And in 2004, 144 of the essays from his column were gathered together into a book of the same name, Islands in the Clickstream. That book, by the way, was extensively updated some years later. I wanted to replay this interview because I am struck by a number of things, but chief among them is how prescient the analysis of Richard Thieme is. In some ways, technology moves so rapidly that much commentary about it is out of date almost as soon as it is uttered. But in the case of Richard Thieme, he is talking about universal and overarching themes that remain very much in play, even if certain specifics within the technology sector change quite rapidly. So here it is then, that interview from 2004, Richard Thieme discussing his book, Islands in the Clickstream. I remember my dear departed colleague Bill Guy talking at great length and with great enthusiasm about an interview which he conducted at a point when I was out of town with someone by the name of Richard Thieme. And Bill had actually a little bit of trouble just succinctly summarizing what the two of them had talked about and exactly what made it such a compelling conversation. But that's something that I never forgot. And in a little treasure trove of interviews which Bill made a point of preserving in that little basket of tapes, one of those interviews indeed was this conversation with Richard Thieme, who indeed is one of the most perceptive commentators before the public today when it comes to issues of technology and society and how all of us sort of consume technology or are affected by it, and the way in which technology is altering the way we live and the way we connect with one another. Richard Thieme has gathered together a number of columns and reflections into a fascinating book called Islands in the Clickstream, Reflections on Life in a Virtual World. And I'm really grateful that Richard Thieme can join us for a few minutes to talk about what has drawn him into this particular realm, his fascination with technology, and more important than that, the way in which technology shapes us, perhaps as much as we shape it. Richard Thieme, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're really glad that you can be here. Just in a nutshell, first of all, tell us how this book was put together and where these various columns and reflections come from.
Well, like most things in my life, it starts off by accident and then it becomes more intentional. I was asked about 8 or 9 years ago by the Wisconsin Professional Engineers Association to do a monthly column for their print magazine that went to members, and I did 3 or 4 or 5 of them, and then I checked to see how they were doing. People really liked them. I started with how to live in cyberspace and dreams engineers have and games engineers play and power generation, relating technology to the shape of our lives, our social and cultural and psychological experience of life as it is being changed by technology. And so I decided to use this new thing, the internet, to offer them to friends. And a number of people signed up for it, and I started sending them out on a regular basis by email. Fortunately, USA Today found my website with those archived on it and spotlighted it as a USA Today site of the day. Now, it tells you how early on in the Internet it was, because a site of the day means there were about 365 of them in a year, and there are probably as many 365 sites coming on board every 10 minutes these days. But at that time, you could still do that. So a lot of people found me and signed up, and one thing led to another. You know, E.B. White said that it's no wonder how complicated things get, what with one thing leading to another. And so that's the way it happened. I started sending them out, and it grew and grew. And sooner or later, I had readers in at least 60 countries that I know of, and they were being picked up and published on websites and then in print and translated in other languages. And how they've really functioned in cyberspace was because of my prior life as both a professor of literature, teacher of literature, and a Episcopal priest, is they were opinion pieces or insight pieces, but they're also kind of sermons, secular sermons, one of the reviews on Amazon calls it, because there's a moral center that I'm always searching for, which is how we can remain most fully human in light of what is happening to us by virtue of this transformative engine called communication information technology. And so the community that gathered around them in cyberspace, I like to think like people around a fire in a dark woods, were looking for illumination. And I didn't know that they would be printed or not. My expectation was that I would die, and then someone would say, hey, you know, these are too good to lose. We ought to publish them. Because I had approached a number of publishers, and a number of them, like Doubleday and Penguin and Putnam and the like, said these are really well-written and very timely, but it's not quite right for our list. Mm. And they were, of course, right. They said it would get lost on our list. Well, that's the nature of commercial publishing. And it's the nature of doing something new, which these really were. They're a genre that hadn't been classified before, that made me say, well, just keep writing. You've got your readers. You have your response. And that builds a platform for my professional speaking, which is what I do as for a living. And to my surprise, Syngris Publishing, a technology publisher, approached me at a conference about 8 months ago and said, do you have something we could bring out? We want to go in a new direction where it's not just hard technology. And one day later, they had the proposal. 2 days later, I had the contract. Hmm. And 6 months later, the book is in print and doing well and getting a good response from people who want to somehow connect the way they know they have been being changed by all this to the deeper concerns of their lives, the ultimate concerns of their lives, their values, their ways of constructing reality, their spirituality, their deeper beliefs and understanding of who they are in the universe. And that's what I try to point toward. I try to be a finger pointing at the moon. I'm certainly no moon.
Have you always been so interested in technology? I'm wondering about earlier in your life when, of course, technology was still there and changing, but, of course, nowhere near at the pace that it seems to change now or the way in which it seems to impact people's lives. I mean, but did technology intrigue you back in the days when an electric can opener was the latest thing?
Well, I don't remember when the electric can opener came on the commercial markets, like saying, you remember the first Ford? No, I do remember the first color TV in our high-rise in Chicago, because my mother won it in a raffle, and all the kids in the building came over, and we sat there tuning the tint and hue buttons until the letters, the show of shows, turned from white to yellow and people burst spontaneously into applause. I remember that moment. I think I've always been – it's a great question. I don't think I've ever been asked that question. And the answer is, when I think about it, yes. When I was a kid, I was very, very interested in ham radio and amateur radio. And I remember as a very young kid sitting with my Hallicrafters S-85 or my Allied Knight Space Banner, a home-built kit before that – fine-tuning. It wasn't digital then. You didn't just punch in a number and let the electronics do the work. You tune that button. I can still see myself at 3, 4 in the morning when the skip was good, just turning that big button and suddenly holding that signal and listening to a ham in Ethiopia or somebody in the Middle East or somebody in Russia and listening routinely to Soviet Union voice. Was it Radio Moscow? And, of course, everybody's heard Quito, Ecuador, HCJB, most powerful station in the hemisphere. Listen to BBC then. And now when I look back on it, an awful lot of people weren't getting their news from Russia and from England. And, in fact, they would send me things in the mail that I remember getting a postcard from the government saying you've been sent communist propaganda. We're sure that you didn't ask for this. But if you would like to receive it, please put your signature on the postcard and return it to the House on American Activities Committee or whatever. And, of course, you didn't return the postcard. So I guess when I look back, I was always interested in the use of technology to extend your reach, to go as far as you could, to understand the depths and complexities of things, and to reach out and hear other voices. And then in the 70s, when the Viking lander settled on Mars, I remember sitting with a video ham, and we watched spellbound as almost pixel by pixel, so slowly the signal came back and began to paint the first picture of the desert of Mars on the monitor. And I remember my astonishment and joy and deep yearning, which has yet to be fulfilled, to go there. I saw Mars suddenly as real as the desert in Nevada next door where I lived then in Utah. And I wanted to climb Olympus Mons. I wanted to go into the depths of Valles Marineris. And suddenly Mount Everest and the Grand Canyon were just a little pit and a little pimple compared to what Mars had to offer. And so that was the use of technology to extend our cognition, our senses, and for me to stimulate our imaginations in a way that takes me far, far, far out to the edges.
One of the things that, of course, is so intriguing about the way technology is different now from, for instance, when I went to college. I graduated in 1982, and when I went to college, absolutely nobody owned their own computer.
Right.
And if you were a computer science major, there was such a thing, you went to the computer science lab, which I never stepped foot in. And at least as far as I could tell as an outsider, although anyone who worked with computers was sort of destined to a solitary existence by and large. Or that's certainly how it seemed. And computers were not used to connect with other computers, let alone with other people sitting at computers. And now, of course, computers have advanced to the stage where now it is not at all a solitary undertaking the way that it once might have been.
No, it's changed us dramatically. One of the consequences, as you just indicated, is that, throughout 20th century, one of the evolutionary ideas of science was the reality of relationships, regardless of what was in relationship one thing to another, the structure of relationships. And networks redefine what it means to be human by the fact of putting us in a different relationship to each other. And that's why information, energy, power all flow differently in a network than they do in other kinds of structures, like hierarchical structures. And this has all come since then. In 1982, 83, that's when I first bought an Apple II for my son, and that's when I had an insight into what distributed computing would mean. But you can go back as far as the 50s. J.C.R. Licklider, a great psychologist, connected with the early ARPA and government development of computing. In 57, I believe it was, he told a group of world-class scientists, the day is going to come when we connect computers to each other and they're going to talk to one another. And they all just made all kinds of derogatory gestures. And these were world-class people who couldn't grasp what he knew very well. At that time, computers were mainframes tended by high priests behind thick glass and air-cooled rooms, not something anybody could get. And that's why hackers evolved the way they were. In 82, 83, when you were in college, what you're talking about, if somebody wanted to know about computing, you didn't just buy a computer. You couldn't get on the internet, which existed, but in a rudimentary form. You had to hack. If you wanted to know how Unix workstation worked, you couldn't afford $50,000 or whatever for one. You had to hack into one. You wanted internet time, you had to go through your university, and that meant you had to figure out how to get on without having to pay for it. In other words, the environment, the cognitive space of early computing invited what we call hacking because it created a world without boundaries. And the big challenge was how do you free the mind? How do you live vibrantly in a world that has no walls? And that's what hackers really were exploring. And then, of course, there's really no justification for that today because anybody can buy all the internet time they want. They can buy a workstation with so much power for next to nothing. They can build their own network. So hacking has changed as well.
Right. It's become quite a different thing. In fact, you talk in one of your columns about how you really want us to be careful about our terms. You like to differentiate between hackers and script kiddies. Now, that's a term I'm not acquainted with. What do you mean by the difference?
Well, in the 60s at MIT, when hacking began to be used I would say ubiquitously in that subculture, to me, in a really ingenious kludge, a really clever way of making something happen that wasn't predictable or conventional. Because a hacker really is somebody who looks at an artifact that's been built, whether it's an intellectual construction or a physical one, and asks this question, not what was it made to do, but what can I make it do? What is there possible latent? And that means you have to see deeper than the structure as presented to you. Often engineers who build these things don't even understand themselves what the thing can be made to do. When the first Sony PlayStation was invented, the engineers brought in a bunch of 10-year-olds and watched them play behind one-way glass and were astonished at the things they invented to do with the PlayStation that they themselves had not designed it to do, but now they understood it. It could be made to do. So hackers are people who, like all great scientists, have passion, obsessiveness, and daring. Those are the characteristics of all great scientists. But as the space has evolved, then the creativity, the originality, the ingenious hack became less important in the distributed public computing space, and people began to automate the functions that previously you had to be very, very good to write the script or program to do yourself. So now there's an acceleration in the availability of scripts, that is, pre-written instructions, which you can access, download, and execute without having any understanding what it is they do. It's kind of like if you bought a first car and you knew how to get under the hood and make it work compared to just buying a car and all you know how to do is turn on the key. And a complex machine works, but you don't know how it works. Well, it's the same with script kiddies. They're kids, and kiddies is derogatory because it implies a lack of knowledge or understanding of what they're doing, and concomitantly often the lack of ethical understanding of what they're doing comes piggyback on that. And so they download scripts, run them, can do powerful things with them, exploits, flaws in all the major systems, but especially the Microsoft products are widely known. Many more are not widely known but are distributed in small select groups. And using those exploits or flaws before they become patched, if patched they ever become, lets you do all kinds of mischievous and sometimes negative things. So real hackers have a great deal of disdain for script kiddies because they're vandals, they're graffiti sprayers, they're breaking and entering people, they're burglars, but they're not ingenious, creative, original people.
So it's not that hackers necessarily or any more well-behaved, but it's at least they did it the hard way.
That's right.
It's like I can play pieces of music in different keys, but I sort of resent the people that sit at an electronic keyboard and press a button which transposes it for them.
Right.
That would be sort of a parallel
right.
image,
that's exactly
I guess.
Right. That's exactly right.
We're speaking today with Richard Thieme, and the title of his very thought-provoking book is called Islands in the Clickstream, Reflections on Life in a Virtual World. Back to the question that we kind of bumped against briefly earlier, and that is of how computers can, in a sense, connect us in ways that we would not have been connected before. I'm part of a listserv of opera fans, and I think for many of us, and probably others on the group more so than me personally, something like this has been such a powerful thing because if you are maybe the only opera fan in some tiny little town in North Dakota, or let's say you're an 18-year-old boy in some little town in North Dakota and you like opera, this is a way for you not to be alone that passion. And I suppose there are countless other examples of how this world has made such a difference for people like that.
For both good and ill. That's the power of distributed computing. It pushes power and presence into the hands of the person who's right up there at the interface, by which I mean it's changed our sense of who we are from a bounded, individual, isolated self to a node in a network. And that's it's kind of like No, I think a lot of the problems that are discussed today, whether privacy or intellectual property or security, are a function of not knowing whether we're looking at the self as an individual, you know, post-Renaissance bounded boundary encased self, or whether we're looking at the quote-unquote individual as a node in a network with semi-porous or totally fluid and open boundaries, whose existence is determined by the free flow of information and energy in and out of the larger system of which they're merely a part. It's like particle and wave. You know, if you look at light as a particle, you get particle. If you look at it as a wave, you get wave. How you set up the experiment determines how you see the thing. Well, if you look at an individual from a legal point of view as a person with a boundary, then they have a right to privacy. But if you look at them as a node in a network, you realize not only do they not have a right to privacy, they don't have any privacy, can't have.
It's not possible.
No, they're radiating information by virtue of being connected to a network to which they are completely transparent. That's what has created the possibility of identifying and linking yourself in these networks, like the Opera Lovers Network, and transcending space and time, being part of a presence to one another that literally didn't exist. The downside, of course, is distributed computing enables non-state terror, because the structures of a society often emulate the shape of its information and communication technologies. And so non-state terror or non-state entities that do terror or cartels or on the other side, trans-global corporations, no longer are beholden to the countries in which they used to live or in which they originated, because those countries, just like the individual that I was talking about, are dissolving. The boundaries around them are becoming semi-porous, and new non-state entities are emerging, which are like great clouds of nebulous power, because we don't know how they relate to this former thing that we all took for granted, a country, a nation, a state of which we were a citizen, but which are in fact, in a way, in terms of power, at least, passing away. So nation-states emerged, you know, in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, as appropriate ways to put a boundary around the level of economic and political and social activity that we had. And now, in fact, that level of activity in distributed networks, such as you identified for your Opera Lovers, it also works for Al-Qaeda and anybody else with a common bond, that's kind of fundamentally undermining the structure of geopolitics, and new things are emerging. And we're living in this transitional time, which, as I say, is why it makes it so difficult. If you don't know how you're looking at the network or how you're looking at the structure of power or the organizational structure, it's true for business, too. If you think it's a hierarchical, top-down system and you can draw it on a chart with boxes and dotted lines and straight lines connecting the boxes, then you're frozen in that way of conceptualizing or mapping the world.
I suppose it's that we are more in the world than we used to be, and other people are all over the world in
That's
a way.
Right.
I mean, in a sense, Al-Qaeda is here.
That's right. They are here. And they're here because what we used to think were boundaries keeping people out are easy to penetrate. We say, gee, in America, anybody can kind of come over the Canadian border, come over the Mexican border, and then reassemble into a cell. Same problem with computer security. I saw an application the other day. It uses a Java applet to attack a firewall. Now, it doesn't attack the firewall frontally because it would lose. Firewall is designed to defend the perimeter of the network. What it does is break itself up into component parts that aren't identifiable as a program, slip through the firewall as information, and then with a program that's kind of like a cornerstone for reassembly, it reprograms or reassembles itself into the program on the other side of the firewall. So it's a Trojan horse that breaks itself into pieces, goes through the walls, the holes in the walls, and then comes back together again on the other side. And what this means is, excuse me, as you were saying, we are absolutely present to one another. Always. And this is, of course, just what mystics have said for a long time, but now there's some data for it.
Is this something we can live with? Because I think there are some people that wonder if this ultimately is the way we should live with this kind of, can we live with this kind of connectedness when there are entities in the world that hate us or that we hate, can we survive this level of connectedness, or do we need to somehow retreat from this?
Well, that was the right next question. Based on what I was saying, I mean, that causes anxiety and apprehension. I mean, but I like to drive things down to a slightly more fundamental level of what are the assumptions buried in the question you ask, and the question was, can we? And that's where I would stop. What do you mean by we? Because the identification of ourselves, our identity, that's what's fundamentally in transformation now, and that's what I find so fascinating. Who we think we are is fundamentally being transformed, not obliterated, but transformed. But to go through a period of transformation genuinely, you go through what I call a zone of annihilation in which everything you thought yourself to be, who you thought yourself to be, is really called into question. And you must be willing to enter into that space of free fall. The Zen adepts call it a nightmare in daylight, in which monsters, i.e. yourself, show up in a form that you had never before seen. And if you go through that period, your psyche will restructure. Can we go through this? Absolutely. We are going through it. And we, that is humankind in tribes and organizational structures of the past, have gone through worse. Many major transitions in the past. We're about, the 25th or 26th identifiable civilization. Well, each one of those civilizations had an end in order for the next one to begin. And we're so provincial, right, in time and space, in how we think we dominate the time. But, you know, America is a couple hundred years old, and I was listening to a series of lectures on ancient Egypt. And when it came to the time between the first and second dynasties, we don't have much information. Things kind of dissolved, and then the Second Dynasty started a couple hundred years later. And he just pointed out that this couple hundred years is equal to the entire history of the United States, and yet it's just kind of a dark blip with parentheses around it between the First and Second Dynasties of a 3,000-year culture. We're children, and humankind, in terms of leaving our planet and exploring our environment, I think we're like toddlers coming down the steps for the first time. We haven't even gone around the block. We're just extending ourselves through our solar system. It's been dramatic from our point of view and wonderful, but all of this is going to fundamentally change human identity, as is genetic engineering. When we can alter our, I call it our subjective space, the field of subjectivity which we inhabit as if it is the horizon of possibility, when we can alter that with subtlety and finesse chemically, both inside as well as ingesting chemicals from without, when we go transplanetary, and these technologies transform us. So your question is a good one. Can we survive? Yes, but who we will be on the other side is not the we who left the shore to begin the voyage. Mm. The we who arrives will be a very different sense of we.
In the meantime, if I can just pull it back from sort of the cosmic dimensions, tell me how someone should react with something as workaday as the bank, that once upon a time the bank was this building and your money was there physically, maybe in that bank, or to some extent anyway it was.
Yeah, we thought it was.
and now our banks don't have walls at all.
No.
Our banks are kind of everywhere. But if we get to a scenario where nobody's money is safe, do we start rethinking about, well, maybe our banks should not be part of this world of complete and utter connectedness? Maybe we have to retreat back to something more tangible.
Right. That would be the fear-based default position, which is, oh my gosh, we're not safe. But what do we mean by safe? There are two things there. I work in security a lot. I do a lot of speeches for security organizations. I'm keynoting MITSEC in December for the Middle East IT Security Conference in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. And I was in Israel in May with Steve Ballmer keynoting Microsoft Israel's conference. So the banks are ubiquitous. Safety is clearly a function of feeling safe enough to function. In other words, there's a difference between real safety, i.e. information assurance, or in the sense of defense, bombs not going off, and the feeling that we are safe. Homeland Defense is a good example. It is focused at least as much on helping people to feel safe or try to as on changing the level of security in the country. With banks, Absolutely. I mean, the bank in our heads is often still mapped to the physical kinds of banking that evolved prior.
Right.
But even when I've worked with banks, I remember confronting some executives off-site because they all talked about the bank as an obstruction to what they wanted to do. And I said, where is the bank? And they realized the bank that inhibited them is the internalized map of banking, which was in their heads because it wasn't on-site. It's the same with banking. The fact is there's a lot of money being stolen out there through extortion and chicanery. And it's not the kids who are doing it. These are highly organized, highly sophisticated gangs, global, often linked to one another. Russian mafia is a big player in that from my limited understanding of it. Money is lost. Is so much money lost that it undermines the banking system? Well, not yet. I talked to somebody, a brokerage investment house guy, and they had lost $600 million in a hit. That sounds like a lot of money. But given what they lose in other ways, it was a cost of doing business. Mm. So what has become clear for banking and finance generally is that it's a question of risk management. Money doesn't know who owns it. Money only knows whether it's moving. And if it's moving, it's doing its job. And so it may be moving because it's being laundered, and it may be moving because it's part of a global transaction. But so long as the collusion between light and dark, between citizens and criminals, and you know that when you look closely, it becomes hard to distinguish citizens and criminals. So long as it does not fundamentally undermine the ability of a global economy to function, then it's manageable. And if it's manageable, then it's a risk that can be tolerated and borne as we adapt to how to do it. So it's just like saying, boy, once we put money in central depositories, why did Willie Sutton rob the bank? Because that's where the money was. Why do people go to cyberspace? Nothing's changed because that's where the money is. But are you impaired? Can you use your debit or credit card? Absolutely. Is the world reasonably stable from a financial point of view? See, that's one of the primary objectives of terror, is to do two things: undermine the belief of a people in its government to protect them, and undermine and degrade the economy. The expectation is the next big attack, if it does come. They've tried many times and they've been stopped, according to my sources so far, is to try to undermine the economy. And in fact, 9/11, this is not a secret. If there had been one Volkswagen packed with explosives at the right place in Wall Street, it could have fundamentally brought down the ability of the financial system to exchange money. But they didn't have a car there. Well, they've gotten better. We've gotten better. It's a cat and mouse, spy versus spy game.
I guess that's part of why, you know, when you tell stories about heinous new viruses that, you know, sneak through the firewall and then reconnect and so on, which, of course, that plays out in all kinds of different ways, too. But I suppose at the same time that we hear a really frightening story about that, there is also the story of good guys and good women that are on the case.
Absolutely.
That are working to help sustain this system which we have created and which, for good or occasional ill, is with us.
That's correct. And my understanding from the work I've done in Washington, or talking to people who are closer to it than I am, is that after 9/11 the gloves came off. You have to think about just from the intelligence point of view. Theoretically, the FBI does internal, the CIA does external. CIA can't listen in to people in this country. We have FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which enables us to, from a secret court, get a warrant if probable cause exists to listen in to foreign nationals. But when you look at what the technology has done, just as I was saying in terms of boundaries, who is local and who is distant is literally impossible to distinguish. The sources of the flow of information that are intercepted or bent to come to us in the first place are multifaceted, and the streams merge. And you cannot say, oh, this is an American and this is a foreign national with the kind of clarity often that you used to be able to. That requires, therefore, policy and the implementation of policy. In other words, how is somebody going to use the information that they get? Well, in the meantime, it means the distinctions we used to make between foreign and domestic intelligence are functionally obliterated to a large degree. That's what bringing down the stovepipes and the silos and all that is about. It's sharing information. Well, what does that really mean? It means organizational structures that were chartered not to talk to each other are now feel powered to talk to each other. inside the government bureaucracy, there is a sense of permission. Always err on the side of get permission later. The urgency of the mission imperative counterterror, as it has been defined, gives people the belief that that's what they need to do. So my understanding is that, yes, we can't kill people here, but we can kill them elsewhere, and we can turn them over to our allies. And we're in bed with some of the people who we think are enemies. People would generally be surprised, I think, to learn how it really works down in the sewers where everybody's so covered with muck that we are indistinguishable from one another. No, we can't torture somebody, but we can turn them over to an Egyptian or a Jordanian and say, go to work on this guy. And they do. So, again, the functional boundaries between what we think of in this country as inhibitions on our behavior that we love to believe make us different from anybody else are, in fact, an illusion, a comforting illusion, sustained in order to keep us snug in the belief that we're fundamentally different. But then sometimes when people overseas react negatively to what we, in fact, do, not what we say or believe about ourselves, but what we do, we're so surprised. Well, that's the way it is.
Well, some just comforting insights in this really extraordinary book. And, you know, we bandy about the term thought-provoking a bit too blithely sometimes, but that really says it well, I think. This book really gets you thinking about life, what it means to be a human being, and the way in which the technology that surrounds us, the way that changes who we are and how we see ourselves and each other. The book, again, is called Islands in the Clickstream, Reflections on Life in a Virtual World, published by Syngress, and its author, Richard Thiem.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now for another interview from the Morning Show archives. This one, a fun conversation from 2013, talking about an exciting undertaking by National Geographic, a project which, by the way, lives on to this very day. We'll tell you about that at the end of the program. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Joel Sartore, who is a contributor to National Geographic magazine. He has been part of the National Geographic family for well over 20 years, a famed nature photographer who does absolutely superb work, which you can view on his own website. And, of course, you see his work in National Geographic. And he is also a frequent contributor to CBS Sunday Morning. In fact, his most recent book, I believe, is a collection of some of his essays called Let's Be Reasonable. Another book which is quite beautiful, I've had a chance to glance at, is called Rare, Portraits of America's Endangered Species. He is one of the participants in something called the Great Nature Project, which is designed to involve all of us in the undertaking of capturing images of the world around us, the world of nature all around us. Joel Sartore, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. Good to be here.
So explain what this project is, the Great Nature Project.
Sure. This is Geographic's basically telling folks, you know what, it's important to pay attention to the nature around us, and it's beautiful and dramatic, and indeed our very survival depends on keeping nature intact. We need pollinating insects like bees to bring us fruits and vegetables, and we need clean water and clean air. And so maybe the first step is to get people up and off the couch and away from the television and the internet and get outside and take pictures of what moves them. It could be flowers, it could be butterflies on those flowers, it could be animals at a local zoo, it could be deer crossing the road, it could be anything that's nature, that says nature to you. You take a picture and then you post it through greatnatureproject.org, or you can send it in to hashtag great nature and hashtag animal, and we're going to try to set a Guinness World Record title, try to get an attempt to set the record for the largest photo album online ever of animals. We need 100,000 pictures to do this. So that's what we're hoping to do, is get people encouraged to get out, get pictures, share their pictures, and build this incredible online photo album, something that the world's never done before.
I suppose one of the important things to say is that people should feel encouraged to do this, even if you don't live in a place where you're likely to see an orangutan or a toucan or something in your backyard. I mean, even the kind of creatures that we might regard as ordinary belong in this album.
That's right. That's right. People don't have to go to Borneo to get pictures. They can shoot in their own backyard. You know, butterflies are amazing. Bees are amazing. praying mantis, they might get lucky and see that, or it might just be flowers. It might be a beautiful tree in the fall. It could be anything. The project is 1 week from September 21st through September 29th, and fall will be coming on in the northern states then. So there's plenty of great opportunities for beautiful pictures. But it's just whatever moves you. And I'd like to encourage people to stay away from their dog or their cat or their goldfish, but try to see nature in a new way. There's beauty all around us, but we have to open our eyes and look.
You've been doing this for a long time, and in fact, before we're done, we'll talk about a project of your own called the Photo Arc. Mm-hmm. Do you have advice for people in terms of getting out there with a camera? Are there maybe common mistakes that a lot of us make when we try to snap a picture of a bird or a squirrel or something?
Sure.
Any advice on how we can do that maybe most effectively to capture especially arresting images?
Oh, sure, Greg. I'm glad you asked. The keys to getting great pictures for National Geographic magazine or for yourself is to shoot in good light. That's beginning or early in the day on a sunny day, or any time on an overcast day when the light is soft. So good light and a clean background. Try to get close enough so the background blurs a little bit, or at least brings your subject up closer. If you can move slowly, you can get really close to most insects, yeah, even with an iPhone. And the third thing is find something interesting. That is really the key, is to find something interesting. And what makes interest? Well, it could just be something that's beautiful or something that looks like an alien. A lot of insects look very alien. Could be a sloth in your local zoo. I mean, they just hang there and they look cute and interesting. So that's really the key, is those three things: good light, clean background, and something worth looking at.
Mm-hmm. If people think they want to be part of the Great Nature Project, where should they go to kind of get started or get all the information they really need?
Oh, sure. There's a website called greatnatureproject.org, greatnatureproject.org. That's a perfect place to start. Very easy. It'll lead people right through the whole thing and explain what we're doing. If they want to take a shortcut, they could send their pictures using #GreatNature and #Animal to participate in the Guinness World Record attempt.
I want to mention before I forget that I believe you grew up in Ralston, Nebraska, and now you live in Lincoln, Nebraska, a place I love. That's where I went to graduate school. But I think a lot of people would be kind of amazed. They would think that somebody like Joel Sartori surely lives in Anchorage or Helena or some place. I mean, we don't think of Lincoln, Nebraska as the hotbed of nature photography. Can you just say a word about why you live where you live?
Oh, sure. You know, I grew up in Ralston. My parents are both alive still in Elkhorn. That's about an hour away. My wife's parents are from Lincoln, and she wanted to live there, and that's fine with me. I think that Lincoln's a nice, pleasant place with low crime rate. The cost of living's low, and all I need is an airport to do my job. I mean, and besides, you know, there's great wildlife to shoot there. We have the migration of the sandhill cranes. We have the Nebraska sandhills there, which is the largest prairie intact, mixed grass prairie intact on our continent, is about 3 hours from me. So there's great stuff to shoot. And I would add that I've worked in all 50 states, and every state has something beautiful to photograph, every single state.
Well, and that's really why I asked, because, yeah. I mean, people need to realize that even if you don't live in Maine, you live someplace where there are images absolutely worth capturing, and all the better if you have to sort of seek them out a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, upstate New York is absolutely gorgeous, reminds me of Alaska. The New Jersey coastline has some of the most amazing migrations of birds. I mean, some of the places you just associate with urban sprawl, not necessarily the case. There's places that are just beautiful. I've been to Milwaukee several times. That's gorgeous.
You bet.
And there's plenty of stuff to shoot, but we just have to open our eyes and look. That's all.
I know that you are also really proud of a project of your own, which is called the Photo Arc, and I've seen some examples on your website. Tell us what the Photo Arc is about.
Well, the Photo Arc, I've been at it about 8 years, and I've got 3,000 species so far. My goal is to get every captive species on Earth using studio lighting and black and white backgrounds to get people to fall in love with these things and realize that half of all species now are at risk of extinction by 2100, by the turn of the next century. So I figured, you know what? Most of us just don't know about these animals. I think if we knew these animals existed, we'd wake up and care. And perhaps be moved to save some of them. So the Photo Arc, and people can see the work at photoarc, photark.com, photark.com. They can go there and they can learn about whatever animals interest them the most. And, you know, there's about 10,000 species captive worldwide. I'm about a third of the way done after 8 years. So if I live long enough, I'm going to try to get them all. It's kind of a lofty goal, but I think it's worth it. I really do.
As I looked at your website, there are a couple of photographs that I absolutely loved. One was titled Lion in the Spotlight, and it is a lion up in a tree caught in a spotlight. And it's a very striking way to view an animal that a lot of us feel like we've seen in every way you can possibly see it, but I've never seen a lion exactly under those circumstances.
Yeah,
it was breathtaking.
Thanks. That was in Uganda. And I should mention the photo arc work I do in between assignments or when I'm giving I do a lot of public speaking, so wherever I go, I take my studio gear. But I'm a National Geographic photographer, and getting out into the field and photographing lions and gorillas and piranhas, that's what I do. So in the case of the lion, that was for a story on the Albertine Rift of Uganda, where some of the lions there have learned how to sleep in trees. And he was just waking up at the end of the day, and he was listening to a female calling in the distance, saying, come on, let's go hunting, I'm hungry. And so he stood up, and he stood there for about 4.5 or 5 seconds. All the pictures have time codes on them, so we can tell that. And then he was gone. So I hung out at the base of that tree in a Land Rover for about 3 hours waiting for him to wake up, and I'm glad he woke up when he did. It was almost too dark to see anything else.
Yeah, patience is rewarded. I also love the photograph that you have of two adorable little koalas clutching each other. Beyond just sort of the wonderful cuteness of that image is, of course, the important point which you're making, which is that koalas are in danger, and this is something you want all of us to be really thinking about, not just koalas, but every threatened species.
That's right. Yeah, in northern Australia, the koala, in places where people numbers are growing and development is spreading, they're in a lot of trouble. Domestic dogs take them, and they get hit by cars, and, when they cut down the forest, they don't have anything to eat. So that was the point of that story. And beyond koala, it's kind of easy to care a lot about things that are so cute. But, what I care about are some of the little things among us, rodents, reptiles, amphibians, especially amphibians. They're in a lot of trouble now. And I'm hoping that we can use some of these charismatic animals like koalas, tigers, lions, to get people to fall in love with the little stuff. And, again, this could be just birds at your backyard bird feeder. It could be insects. It could be butterflies on flowers in your backyard. It's anything that you find moves you. These are all entrees into what we call the tent of conservation. When you learn a little bit about these animals, you realize that it's all tied together, and it's tied to our future. After all, it's really folly to think we can doom other species to extinction and not have it come back to bite us very hard.
I know that your interest in all of this, it says on your website, dates to seeing a photograph as a youngster of the last passenger pigeon. So it's no wonder that you have this concern, or that your work in this field is taking on the shape that it is.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we lost a passenger pigeon, 1914, I think. But that bird numbered in the billions, and we had market hunted it to just to nothing, to one bird in the Cincinnati Zoo. And when it went out, that was it. And that was a long time ago. But We're on track to lose a bunch more if we don't pay attention. And the good news is that most of the species that I photograph can be saved, but we just have to know about it. We have to know about it, pay a little attention, and hopefully things will take care of themselves. And this Great Nature Project and the photo arc also, those are, we hope, good entrees for people to wake up and get outside, get off the couch, and see the world around them in a new way.
Joel Sartore from the National Geographic Society in an interview from 2013. The Great Nature Project operated under the direct auspices of the National Geographic Society from 2013 to 2015, and the project lives on in a collaboration with iNaturalist, with new photos still being welcomed. To date, over 500,000 images from thousands of people from more than 100 countries feature 20,000 different species of plants, animals, and fungi. You can get more information at inaturalist.org. And tomorrow on The Morning Show, an astonishing and absolutely true story from rural Hungary in the early 20th century, a small village where a number of women engaged in systematic poisoning of abusive spouses. And the story is told in an incredible book by Patty McCracken called The Angel Makers. You'll hear my interview with the author talking about this astonishing story.